Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, welcome back. I'm delighted to introduce the next speaker, Professor Chiara Cordelli, who is Professor of Political Science and Philosophy at the University of Chicago and works at the intersection of political economy and democratic theory, and is the author of, among other things, a book called The Privatized State with Princeton University Press, and is going to talk about capitalism, alienation, and the rule of none. So
thank you very much, Lea, for organizing this, and everyone for coming. So actually today I'm going to present some material from my second book, provisionally entitled Rule of None, A Political Theory of Capitalism, which tries to develop, as I will explain in a second, a normative critique of capitalism that can provide a sort of alternative compared to already existing critiques. This is what I will focus my talk today. So there has been an interesting silence about capitalism in the last decades, also not only in political philosophy, but also in critical theory, which have been a major sites for the analysis of capitalism, whereas political philosophy, in some sense, never even fully developed the categories to talk in a distinctive way about capitalism. If we think about one of the Bibles of political philosophy, Rawls's theory of justice, the word capital, income, wealth, they are all used interchangeably. But there has been definitely a resurgence of critiques recently. One was precisely developed by Rawls in his later work, and what I call the liberal egalitarian critiques. And the idea here is that capitalism is unsustainable and incompatible with the principle of justice because in the long run generates wide inequality that undermine fair equality of opportunities as well equal opportunities for political influence. But this critique is to some extent largely contingent, not particularly distinctive. Inequality is not a distinctive problem about capitalism. And also, it's not something that we need to leave capitalism in order to overcome. We might think about regulations such as campaign finance or other forms that would mitigate these concerns but staying within a capitalist order. So the second and perhaps most famous critique has been the analytical Marxist critique with scholars such as Jerry Cohen and Romer. Here, of course, the crucial idea is that the distinctive or inherent ill of capitalism concerns exploitation, the extraction of surplus values from labor, but then analytical Marxism wonder, well, is exploitation always unjust? Well, not, Romer said recently, is only unjust when it happens against a background of unfair accumulation. Otherwise, exploitation under capitalism can be perfectly just. And so the problem with capitalism is a distributive one. But also this critique has been, is to some extent contingent. We can find non-exploitative places under capitalism. It seems therefore that exploitation to some extent also depends on the subjective disposition of particular capitalists. And it's also contingent, as I just mentioned, on the background of distributions. So against this critique, there has been a third one, which by now I would say is the dominant normative critique, which is interesting from the perspective of intellectual history because it comes from the encounter of Marx and the socialist tradition on the one hand, and the revival of republicanism through the work of Philip Pettit. And republicanism here is a theory that centers on an idea of freedom as non-domination. I'm free when I'm not under the arbitrary or the unchecked or uncontrolled power of someone else. And so what the radical republicans argue is that there is something inherently wrong about capitalism, and this consists in a particular form of domination. Capitalism structurally dominates by conferring through private ownership, the power to some to unilaterally control the labor of others, and this is because others, that is, non-owners, are forced to work for owners in order to access subsistence. And importantly, this form of domination is non-contingent, they claim, unlike exploitation, because by the mere fact of owning the means of production, ipso facto, I have the power to control the labor of others. And this is a form of domination, whether I'm benevolent or not, in the same way in which a slave is dominated by a master, even if the master is benevolent and actually happen to treat the slave well. So it's a wrong that is non-contingent on subjective dispositions. So against this background, my goal today is mostly to try to sketch, to propose the need for an alternative and still normative critique of capitalism, and to argue that this, especially radical Republican, has some limits, and analyzing those limits brings to light the importance and centrality of investment and monetary valuation that all those critiques have neglected because they're very much almost exclusively focused on labor relations. So my work very nicely follows up on Martin, this idea that for a long time investment but also monetary valuation have been absent from an analysis of capitalism in political theory. So this, my critique will focus on this neglected side of analysis and will try to argue that when we think about this side of analysis, the diagnostic categories that have been dominant of domination and exploitation are not apt to diagnose what is ultimately the problem we've been subject to capitalism's mode of investment. This is an important upshot because what I try to argue instead, the problem should be understood as a form of social alienation that is specific to capitalism, and therefore the point of socialism is not so much distribution, community, or the fight against domination as has been traditionally understood, but it should be understood as a process of reconciliation, when reconciliation is the goal of constructed and non-alienated relations between citizens and their social political world. And finally, that this has important institutional implication because we shouldn't think about economic democracy so much as limited to labor relations, but it's very important to think about the planning and democratization of finance, of investment, and in particular of credit allocation. So, very briefly, and I will try to stay on time, let me say something about the core Republican critique. The core thesis, as I mentioned, is that Republican domination, the fact of being subject to an arbitrary power, is an inherent wrong under capitalism and is non-contingent because, unlike exploitation, domination under capital does not depend on whether the capitalist is benevolent or not. The owners of the means of production, precisely like slave masters, always dominate qua owner, regardless of their subjective disposition. So here we should really ask, is it true, does ownership of the means of production suffice for domination? And do private owners under capitalism always dominate, precisely in some sense how slave masters do? And I'm going to try to answer this question, not so much because I'm interested in answering this question as such, but because answering them bring us to examine, I think, the underlying economic account that is presupposed by the Republican critique. And we will see that once the economic account changes, also necessarily changes the normative story that we should say about, tell about capitalism. So what allows the radical Republicans to develop that thesis? Well, I think something like this, this economic account, and here I quote one of the radical Republicans, because the seed corn, so the savings from past labor, is concentrated in a few hands, so is the value of the net product that it helps produce. And since unilateral control over the net product confers unilateral control over labor, the seed corn, savings from past labor, becomes something it was not in a non-capitalist economy, namely control over person in the form of control over a thing. So what does this economic account mean? Well, I think it assumes that savings from past labor, so the means of production I own, land, machines, but also accumulated savings, in the example, say, accumulated seed corns, are sufficient to enable me, who I own those accumulated past savings, to control the process of production. And therefore, because I own those savings, I can unilaterally control the labor of others. Therefore, ownership in this sense is sufficient to give me control over labor and to give me the power to dominate. And therefore, private ownership of the means of production is sufficient for domination. And owner, qua owners, by the mere fact of having private ownership over the means of production, always and necessarily have that power and therefore dominate. Now, I think the problem with the economic, these economic accounts are important. Here, I rely also on a post-Keynesian readings of recent economic theory. But I think here there are crucial points that, that can be agreed upon, perhaps independently of a specific post-Keynesian economic theories, which is, one is that past savings, so the accumulated product of past labors and the means of production, like land, machines, are insufficient to reproduce, to support the reproduction of the process of production, because there cannot be further production without first the capitalization of those past savings and those means of production. And by here, by capitalization, I mean some mode of valuation where an asset is capitalized when it is invested with monetary value in the present on the basis of its expected future profitability. So to illustrate with an historical example, think about the Rust Belt in the 1980s in the US. Now, if we look at the historical record, the rate of past savings was the same. The intrinsic value of means of production hadn't changed. The number of workers willing to be exploited had not diminished. What happened, however, is that 2 million jobs were lost because an enormous amount of manufacturing companies had to shut down because as a consequence of the Volcker shock, so the chair of the Fed increasing interest rates to fight inflation, investment went somewhere else. Those means of production, those savings were not capitalized. They moved to the Silicon Valley, they moved to other places that then will become the later on the Silicon Valley. And therefore, by being failed to be capitalized, they were inert and unable to support the process of production. But so capitalization is necessary to support the reproduction of the productive process, but which assets are capitalized importantly depends on the volume and the direction of investment in productive capital goods. But the volume and the direction of investment does not depend only on the rate of past savings, but depends on investors' subjective expectations. So, and to make another example closer to our, think about car sharing companies like Uber. They went on the market, they had multi-billion dollar valuation, but they did not even own the cars. They did not even own many of the means of production. And the reason why their valuation was possible, valuation that reproduced their ability to then control labor, was because investors expected a future with a different kind of transportation. So it's a trust in the future, not accumulation from the past, that allows largely the reproduction of the productive process. So the capacity to produce and thus the actual power to control labor depend on investor subjective expectations and disposition about the future, not just past extraction. So capitalism as a particular temporality. So why is this story important? Well, for as far as radical republicanism is concerned, I think it's important because it demonstrates that ownership is insufficient for domination, because no capitalist can unilaterally control the process of capitalization, which goods will be invested with monetary value, and therefore ownership rights over the means of production and accumulated past the fruits of past labor is insufficient to confer to the owner the power to control labor in the future. Therefore, private ownership is insufficient for domination. And in this sense, owners are not like the slave masters example used by Republicans, because they do not always dominate, because the owner of the means of production's power of interference, so the power to control labor, unlike the slave master's power, is conditional on an external process of monetary valuation that the owner does not unilaterally control, and that importantly cannot be conferred by legal institutions alone, because as I said, is an expectation-based driven process of investment. This also means that the amount of domination under capitalism, precisely like the amount of exploitation, is contingent on subjective dispositions as well. It's just not the disposition of the owners of the means of production, but the disposition of investors and their attitudes toward uncertainty and toward the future. So there is no philosophical advantage in terms of non-contingency of the Republican view compared, for example, to the analytical Marxist view. But this is not what I'm mostly perhaps interested here in doing. What I want to argue is that even if we thought radical republicanism provided a less contingent, more compelling critique of capitalism compared to already existing one, I think it would still be insufficient, and precisely because it relies on an economic model that obscures the centrality, as I've tried to argue, of capitalization, that is, of monetary valuation and of investment. So why is investment so central to capitalism? Well, first, for economic reasons, as my example try to show, investment, also thanks to the widespread institutionalization of credit under capitalism, makes production possible even when savings are absent, like in the case of Uber. But it also makes obstacles production when savings are present, because there can be savings, but investor might decide to speculate rather than to invest them in productive activities. And this is when they use money as a store of value, which becomes very widespread under especially financial capitalism. By investment, I think it's also conceptually central to capitalism, actually to capital, because if capitalization, as I've tried to argue, is what transforms inert objects, means of production, into actually productive capital, then investment, which drives this process, is what makes capital inherently dynamic and conceptually distinct from, example, from wealth, which is just stuff that is accumulated from the past, not valued in relation to expectation concerning the future. And this leads me to the third centrality of investment to capitalism, which is that investment is central to the temporal distinctiveness of capitalism, because it shows how production under capitalism, unlike, for example, in feudalism, is oriented toward fulfilling investors' claims made on the future, not toward present consumption alone. And investors' expectation about an open and uncertain future, not just past accumulation, as we said, is what determines the economic present. So if the mode of investment under capital is so central to what capitalism is and how distinctive it is from also other economic systems, From a normative perspective, I think a critique of capitalism has to grapple with this central question. What might be amiss or wrong with being subject to capitalism mode of investment rather than modality of organizing labor relations, for example? And I think here, in my view, we should start from a conceptualization of the mode of investment as a form of rule, not in the technical sense that the mode of investment imposes binding obligation on us, because it does not have authority, but in the sense that unlike other forces like the rule of law or gravity, it does not, however, either only impose constraints on us. Rather, the investment process makes basic structural and transformative decisions about the course of society. So we may say it sets the ends of society by establishing what gets valued, what gets disvalued, what commitments a society can and will pursue, etc., etc. So it determines which possible futures will become actual. How does it do that? Well, we see it today with AI, right? Investment in AI will dictate what jobs will exist, how we will spend our free time, what kind of human beings we will be, etc., etc. So it does so by setting the overall rate of investment, how much investment, and so also growth that will be in a society, its distribution between different geographical eras, the contraction or expansion of existing industrial capacity, and so what kind of objects will exist in the world, what kind of jobs, and the support of entrepreneurship and innovation, what kind of technological innovation we will have, how much, and what the effects will be. So the mode of investment is a rule, but the interest is the rule of whom. Who rules? And here, I try to argue that it's the rule of none, because very quickly, investors are not a collective agent to which we can attribute the making of investment decisions, of the pattern, investment patterns as a whole, or responsibility for those patterns. They're not a collective agent because there is no shared decision-making procedure for forming shared intention. They're not a class because it's an internally competitive bunch. So the success of fossil fuel investments depends on the failure of green tech investments. So there is no shared interest and shared intentions that unify the investors group as a class. And I think they don't even qualify as a diffuse collective. Because for the same reason, their internal competitiveness, they don't even always share basic behavioral propensities. But even if they qualified, as some argue, as a diffuse collectives, this would be insufficient to making them a ruling agent. Further, investors must act under structural constraints, and these constraints ultimately largely dictate what they cannot do and cannot do. So investors are themselves ruled by the structural constraints of capitalization, the logic of capitalization and competitions. So because of these reasons, if there is a ruling entity, it's not the agent of investors as a group, but is the mode of investment as such. And as I said, this is an impersonal entity. And so the investment process rule, but it's an informal, impersonal rule. It's what I call the rule of known. And this is true even if, of course, Elon Musk, the big tech, the asset managers, much more power than all of us combined. But that does not suffice to identify an investor group as a ruling agent. So the normative question becomes, what's wrong with being subject to a form of impersonal rule? And here, of course, critical theories. I'm thinking about Moshe Postone in the 90s, but more recently Roberts, Mao, Battistoni have argued, well, of course, what is wrong is a form of impersonal domination. We are dominated impersonally by markets, by capitalism. We could add the investment process. But I think the notion of impersonal domination is incoherent, and that's not only because there is no will, so it's impossible to be dominated by a non-agential entity that does not have a will, but also because it's constitutive of the idea of domination, a certain kind of inegalitarian relations. Domination presupposes an asymmetry, an inegalitarian status harm, where, like the slave and the master, by being subject to someone's power, I'm treated as an inferior. But the status harm, I think, is absent in the case of economic structures, because in theory, we can all be equally subject to the domination of capital or to the logic of capitalization. And so what makes domination a distinctive notion renders it inapplicable to the case of subjection to market structure. So what is then the problem if non-domination we've been subject to impersonal market? And I try to speed up. Well, I think we need to, in order to answer this question, first to very quickly grapple with some of the core descriptive features of the mode of investment under capitalism. It is privatized. So major investment decisions are left to private actors and is anarchical in the technical sense that investment markets unavoidably produce wasteful and irrational outcomes because they are uncoordinated, there is no ex-ante planning, and because investors are not expected to invest on what they believe is most valuable, but in their guesses about what other people will invest in, and without ex-ante coordination, as Keynes also pointed out beyond Marx, this is structurally prone to generate wasteful outcomes. So if these are the core descriptive feature, what is the normative problem with being subject to a mode of investment that has these features? And I think the problem is the following, that because of the privatization of investment, citizens cannot be reasonably expected to understand large chunks of their society and their course that result from the investment process as the result of their collective valuing and doing, rather than as the product of impersonal and largely uncontrolled market forces. Because these macro investment decisions are taken out of democratic control and joint control, as a citizen, I cannot be reasonably expected to understand the society that results from the investment process as something that I have contributed to author. And because of anarchy, citizens cannot be reasonably expected to affirm their society as an expression of their reflectively endorsed priority, and to relate to the economic and social structure that comes from the investment process as an object worthy of their affirmation, because that structure, as I've argued, is the result of an irrational game and it is wasteful. So what is the problem then with the fact that citizens cannot understand their society as something that they have authored? They cannot affirm it as reflecting their own priorities. I think it's not a problem of domination because the structure is impersonal. It's not a problem of relational equality because in some sense we can all be equally subject to it. It's not even the problem necessarily merely of the fact that we are subjected to decisions we could not reasonably consent to, because it might happen at some point that the investment process maybe produces rational outcomes. But there is something I think that we can capture about the wrong of the situation. If we think a case at the individual level, it might be helpful even if far-fetched. So imagine that at some point in your life you have delegated transformative decision about your life to a computer machine. The computer machine is rational. The computer machine is transparent. And it's also trustworthy. But we might think that there would be something amiss with living your life, especially as time progresses, under the decision-making of a computer machine. And what would then this problem be if it cannot be domination, relational equality, or authoritarianism? And I think the problem is captured by an old concept, but here I take a particular interpretation of that concept, which is the idea of alienation, not understood as externalization or objectification like Lukács or Marx, but in a different way. And I think the problem is this, because under the computer machine, our life, we would not have ongoing involvement in the making of transformative decision, and because we would not be the author of those decisions, our life would be something that we would be unable to affirm and understand as expressing our agency and our priorities. And so we could not relate to our resulting life as something ours, as opposing to an alien imposition, and we could not relate to it as something that we could affirm and identify with, rather than as something that is alien to us. So we would stand in this respect toward our life in an alienated relations, and the phenomenology of this fact would not be the phenomenology of domination, of ingratiation, of subjection, but it would be a sense, a feeling of powerlessness and detachment from a life that is ruled by a computer machine. And I think, and here I stop, that capitalism, the core inherent problem with subjection to the capitalist mode of investment, especially nowadays, is a distinctive form of social alienation, because due to the privatization of investment, citizens under capitalism cannot understand their society, which largely result from past investment, as the result of something that they have democratically, collectively decided, and also decided according to which values should be created. And also due to anarchy, they cannot affirm it as expressing their reflectively endorsed priority, or as an object that is not wasteful and sufficiently rational to be fit to be affirmed. So capitalism, precisely like the computer machine, structurally generates an alienated, non-authorial, non-affirmative relationship between citizens and their social political order. And I think that because of this, the only solution or the only exit to this problem is a form of economic democracy that takes investment decisions, especially macro and mid-level investment decision, this macro decision about, for example, the example of from today would be decision concerning the development of technology such as AI, and socialize them, democratize them through a form of decentralized democratic planning where citizens at different level of the political structure can play decisions in making as a decision about the allocation of credit and about crucial investment decisions that under capitalism instead are privatized. And the planning would also take care of the problem of waste and anarchy. And this is why I think this project ends up with a form of economic democracy that includes financial democracy and is much broader than what radical republicanism generally defend, which instead a form of workplace democracy, a democracy that mostly concerns the structuring of labor relations. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.